let's get going through this stuff. So this, I don't have a particular PowerPoint that we've made, you know, specifically to go through all the critters like in an evolutionary tree, but just some tidbits here and there from different papers, which I thought was kind of cool with the content that we've been covering. So it's going to be somewhat of a epileptic seizure. Okay. But we'll go through it. I think it's pretty fun. In the sense of seeing the different content, there is some theme to it all, as you'll see as we get through it. But I thought a lot of focus on the invertebrates, because on a comparative basis, there's some really interesting papers in the olden days where they were actually questioning Huxley's model and A.V. Hill's model, because it didn't fit so easily when you were starting to look at the invertebrate skeletal muscle. So it's kind of fun. And we can go through some of this. A lot of invertebrate critters, as you know, and a lot of variety out there. So if we kind of just think about it, you know, types of skeletal systems with the muscle, and I know all of you are pretty much already in tune with all this, but zoologists generally, you know, hit these three different types: hydroskeleton, exoskeleton, endoskeleton. We start to think about these hydroskeletons. It's really neat about how they move, like earthworms. You know, the circular muscle, longitudinal muscle, helps them get through, say, the soil, right? So you think about these circular muscles, longitudinal muscles, and how they work. And some really neat varieties of animals out there. And these muscles, I should have put up one of the leech. The leech one was really quite interesting. They actually used the leech neuromuscular junction as an assay for acetylcholine. And because they knew acetylcholine was the transmitter of the leech neuromuscular junction, and actually to figure out like acetylcholine in your spinal cord, they were actually grinding up the spinal cord of dogs and cats, grinding it up and putting it on the leech neuromuscular junction as an assay to see if acetylcholine was actually in the spinal cord or in the brain of different animals in the olden days. So you think about these neuromuscular junctions being used as assays to figure out neurotransmitters in other animals. That's kind of weird history, but it's out there. But the leech neuromuscular junction is a very difficult one to actually work with, because the muscles are so small, you can't stay in them very well with an intracellular electrode. So people have used other models like the earthworm to look at muscle potentials and understand how muscle contracts in these different ways to have very odd mobility for these animals. You know, where the circular muscle contracts, longitudinal muscle has a relaxation, and then the longitudinal muscle contracting. So working out these kind of circuits, if you will, and understanding the rhythmicity of how to activate these muscles. And then knowing that some of these muscles, like when they were looking at the insect, they would contract, but without the nerve, you know, a one-to-one stimulation. So we can go through a little bit of that, called asynchronous muscles. So these hydroskeletons, quite interesting when you think about how they move too, you know, by this ejecting propulsion of water, for example. You've all probably seen, you know, jellyfish and squid and how they work. And, of course, some really neat models with the understanding the nervous system in these animals, but also people trying to understand the neural network and how it controls the muscles, because it's not organized in like a ganglion and then just those muscles. It has a neural network, and when you touch on one side, these sensory receptors then activate those motor neurons to cause these to contract, but a different response on the other side of the animal. So it's very weird. It's still hard to this day. People haven't worked out how that neural network even controls some of these muscles that are in these animals. So it's really neat. There's a guy down at Wilmington, North Carolina, in the marine lab that uses these animals to actually understand some of their coordinations and how the muscles work in unison for movement. And of course, an exoskeleton is really quite neat when you think of the insects and crustaceans, arthropods in general, articulating legs, right? And really neat critters to work with, because of the diversity that's out there as well. And then, you know, they have to shed their exoskeleton to grow. So you think about what happens to the muscle attachments. If you had to, you know, say your muscles, you didn't have the bone inside, your muscles attached to your skin, and how does an animal move then? Is it attached from skin to skin? Or is there something inside? You know, how can the animal move if it doesn't have a skeleton, an internal skeleton? Well, some very weird attachments are quite neat in the arthropods to think about how they do this, but also the whole point about how they molt and grow is amazing as well. So if you think about how do they make internal attachments, like for tendons, it's a different type of structure. So let's think of the exoskeleton, you know, on the animal, the chitin, no internal skeleton, but how could you make something where muscles could attach on the inside? So think of a box, if you will. And then on that box, you fold in the top of the box, right, the flaps on the top. But you fold them in so they can have an invagination inside that box, right? So now you have exoskeleton on the outside, endoskeleton on the inside, but you fold it inside like that. Now you have something that's inside the animal, basically. So what they do is have attachment points from that invagination of the exoskeleton to the exoskeleton on the outside over here. So if you cut through this, do a cross-section through there, you see endoskeleton, these different names, but then exoskeleton is the most inside part, right? And then think about the exoskeleton becoming kind of soft right here on both sides where it invaginates. And that is like a leather-like structure. That's now articulating membrane. So if that articulating membrane invaginates in, but now you have cuticle on the inside, now you can have something that can move, right? Like a little hinge. So that's how these animals actually have internal attachment points from what they call a tendon to the exoskeleton, but really in these kind of invertebrates, they call it an apodeme, because it's not a true tendon. So this apodeme can move because of the articulating leather-like structure. And it's really odd, I should have brought one in here, but it's really cuticle that just softens up in development. And so that's what they call articulating membrane. But think of that articulating membrane being connected to the next joint as well. So now you have this tendon, but you have that articulating membrane to the next joint, and you put little hinges from the cuticle to the cuticle on the other side, just a little, like a little clasp knife that could be in there for a hinge. So you just have to develop that, and now you have a hinge between the two sides. If you have that articulating membrane around that hinge, then you can move, much like, you know, a door, if you will, in that sense. So this exoskeleton is very odd in the way that those apodemes come in, but now you think about how a crustacean or an insect molts and grows. They don't grow internally, you know, like bone growing. How do they grow? They shed their exoskeleton, right? So how do they shed their exoskeleton with all those muscles attached? It's really bizarre. They actually shed the apodeme as well. So if you look at an exoskeleton that's been shed, then you will actually be able to see all the cuticle on the outside, but you look inside, break it open, you see these little structures inside. They actually shed the whole exoskeleton. So the endoskeleton is making this new structure on the inside, and how do they shed that apodeme? It's bizarre, right? And the muscles are attached. And so now it makes that new layer. The animal can take in fluid, hemolymph, you can expand their hemolymph, expand their cuticle, that's how they grow, then harden back up, and all those muscles are attached. Now, when you think about when they just molt, the cuticle's soft, right? So they can't really contract because it's too soft, because they have to enlarge that and then put calcium back into their cuticle to harden back up again. So behaviorally, they have a lot of changes when they're going through these molts. And it's kind of odd in many crustaceans like crabs, crayfish, and all those guys, lobsters, that there's a difference even sexually about the molting cycle. So usually they molt with the seasonal changes, and you'll hear people like in California and Florida, you know, call in and say, hey, all the crabs are dying. You know, the blue crabs in Texas, for example, on the coast, lots of blue crabs in the ocean, they're all dying. And then, you know, the people that are used to it, like Fish and Wildlife, they'll say, no, they're just going through a molt cycle, because all these cast skins will wash up on the beach, right? Thousands of them. The whole beach is just covered with all these cast skins. But the females molt first, and then the males actually go around the female, the blue crabs, and protect the female and they actually then change a spermatheca, a packet of sperm, to the female at that time. And he'll actually hold on to the female and protect her until she hardens up. And then the males molt. So it's this weird cycle that goes on. What's the difference? People are still trying to figure out how the temperature affects the females differently than the males, like in the blue crab species. So it's really neat because that's a... Pardon?
To the females, protect the males.
No.
It's
a problem. So it means
differently. I'm done with you.
Right. He doesn't know you start.
By the system. And if you ever play with a blue crab or a lobster, you know, the Chinese market that's over here on Waller, Yo-Yo Market, or however they pronounce it, they sell blue crabs every once in a while. I go over and get them for our neurophys class. They are vicious animals. I mean, they will really, you know, tear you apart. They're very cannibalistic, too. In their tanks, they just kill each other if I don't try to get in little houses to get them separated. But when you see that molt, it is unreal, right? They hunker down to, even lobsters or crayfish, they'll basically go away at the time of molt because they're so susceptible to predation at that time. What's interesting is you don't think that they really need to contract very much because they can't. I mean, their cuticle's too soft, but the things that harden up right away are the mouth parts and actually their chelipeds. What's really interesting is you think of a lobster claw. And we were talking about this before, Tim and I, about the lecture we heard a number of years back in biology. The lobster claw, look at it next time you go to Kroger, for example, in the lobster tanks. Those big claws, right? Big muscle in there. And the leg is very narrow at the base. So not only is it weird that they molt, right, and extend their body out, like grow, fill up with the air, but they're filling up with fluid, and then harden back up. But when they molt, they have to break that old exoskeleton. Usually they'll break between their abdomen and their thorax, and they just kind of back out of their clothes. You know, like if you just pulled your shirt up, pulled the pants down, basically. So they back out that way. But those claws are so big, that muscle is so big, it really couldn't come through the base of the claw. So what happens, if you look at the lobsters, or if you go to Red Lobster, it's too expensive, but anyways, go there, or go to Kroger and buy them, you will notice that there's a little spot on the base of their claw where the cuticle will start to degrade, and it comes like a little triangle, leather-like structure. And actually, the cuticle that goes around the leg, they'll actually pull apart, and that becomes a leather-like. And it's a really well-demarked structure. So people are trying to figure out if the Dyson receptors that are there that actually cause that cuticle to start breaking down, but not the rest of the cuticle that much. And then what happens when they molt, this muscle still couldn't come through. It atrophies. It atrophies up to 40% of its muscle mass. But guess what? The thoracic muscles don't atrophy. So how is it so selective to these big claw muscles and the leg muscles to atrophy 40% of their mass and then can pull their muscle through that leg, that little opening, but that articulating membrane can spread out. And then when the animal fills up with hemolymph and expands back out, all that articulating membrane starts to turn back to cuticle. And it keeps doing that, you know, throughout the cycle. What's really odd is it sheds that apodine too. It's just bizarre how that muscle could attach, right, like that. So it's really quite neat to think about these different structures. You might not realize, but like crustacean muscle, crab muscle, was used because in physiology a long time ago to actually understand ion transport. So you hear about exchangers all the time, you know, sodium bicarb, potassium co-transport and exchangers and sodium potassium pump. Actually, the crab muscle was the one that was used for all these studies because it was so big they could put electrodes inside of it. And then they could actually change the intracellular concentration, and they used radioisotopes as well. So they actually looked and understood transporters and co-transporters. Some of the first tissue to really look at that was crab muscle because of the size. And then people noticed there were some really nice structures with it too. So let's go through a little bit of some of these fun things with the exoskeletons, and we'll talk a little bit more about it as well as we go on. Okay, and then we got endoskeletons. And as we know about these creatures already pretty much, right? And the structure of endoskeletons, very, very strong. But chitin's quite strong, too. If you try to dissect some of these hard lobsters, or if you know if you've ever tried to break open a claw, that's quite hard tissue. Okay, so let's just think about some of these locomotions, appendicular locomotion, axial locomotion, and understanding some of these differences about, like Tim was mentioning before, you know, if we have a lot of inertia to get over if we're walking on the ground, and You know, you think about in the water, there's not as much effect of the gravity because you're in the water, you can glide, but the different kinds of systems of actually moving. So I kind of pulled, I stole this part off the internet from somebody else. So this is kind of neat because you have animals like a leech that could undulate, but here we actually have the whole body moving versus some of the fish that just move the back of the tail. And actually these different types of muscles, like we've been talking about in general, you know, fast, slow muscle, being different in the different regions of the animal for their purpose. And so it's kind of interesting when you compare across the species and their locomotion, the different types of muscles that are present. So let's get through this a little bit. And we know, you know, like birds swimming with their feet, so keep using their paddles basically to get through the water. Okay, and then we go to us, right, vertebrates, trying to get through that locomotion as we've talked about already. And, you know, one step forward. And where did we get to? We've got to our favorite little animal that somebody liked, our wallabies, right? And so as we talked about already with those, and then you think of your wonderful frog that we've seen and all the neat recordings. And then we think about animals flying in the air. So we think about insects, flying reptiles, all these animals with comparisons and different muscles that are used to propel them, but also the limitations. I mean, how big can a flying animal be? And then you think back to the dinosaurs, right? And what their muscles must have been like to be able to have that large body moving, right, and functioning. And if it was cold, would they be able to move? Are they heterotherms or homeotherms, right? And that's still a debate a lot to, you know, try to think about. So a cold, an animal that's an ectotherm that changes their body temperature with the environment, all that biochemistry slows down also, right? But then you think about the size of that animal to be able to do that. There's some interesting aspects with this. All right, so let's go to seeing some of these creatures. There's our wonderful dinosaur. All right, so asynchronous muscle versus synchronous muscle. Quite interesting to hit on these two a bit more. And there was a nice paper that I dug out of the literature a little bit, you know, back 2000, but really went over two different species of asynchronous and synchronous muscle. What do we mean by asynchronous and synchronous? Synchronous means the nerve impulse to the muscle contraction. Asynchronous, you just need some background activity of the nervous system, and the muscle will contract on its own kind of rhythm, right? A lot of times you see the ways inside the animal, it's almost somewhat like a box. If you had this muscle to contract, you know, the two vertical walls basically, that could then stretch these two walls up, right? If you push this down, that kind of stretches, and that causes this muscle to want to then contract too. But it needs that background activity of the nervous system to keep the asynchrony going. So if you cut the nerves, then it wouldn't work so well. But the synchronous, then one-to-one. And then you think about how fast maybe this locust, you know, if you were going around and you hear a locust that fly by you, they can go pretty quick, right? And so generally, some of these synchronous creatures are actually very fast moving. So let's go through some of these differences and look at some of the comparative aspects. So it's really neat. Almost three quarters, at least from this reference, of the species are asynchronous flights. So the majority of animals in the world actually use asynchronous muscle for contraction when you look at it species-wise, right? Just the number of beetle species alone, more than all the other species, right? So think of these frequencies, of how fast these animals can actually work. Asynchronous, 20 hertz for some of these insects, all the way up to 1,000 hertz in little MIGs. Those are the tiny, small little insects. So that's pretty fast movement, right? But what I've been able to dig out of this paper, for example, high frequency, you actually get high frequency in synchronous muscle too, like we've talked about before. The rattlesnake is synchronous, and we've talked about the toadfish, the sound-producing toadfish, that's synchronous. So you can get high frequency with synchronous muscle as well, but the real, some of these winners are this asynchronous muscles. And then a cicada that you probably heard, you know, beating around in the springtime, 550 hertz, that's pretty quick. So what we've been able to kind of pull out of the literature here is some really interesting aspects. What do you think would be different in these synchronous and asynchronous muscles when you think about their frequencies and being able to relax and contract? Relax and contract. So remember the midterm questions that we had about rates of contraction? Then you think about how fast that calcium can be taken back up in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So then you think about how much sarcoplasmic reticulum must be there in that muscle if you started to look at it and structure. And then we think about, well, do you want a big muscle with sarcoplasmic reticulum around it, or do you want a bunch of small muscles with sarcoplasmic reticulum around those, right? So structure, function type of relationship here. So pretty neat to think about. So that's what I pulled out of some of these other papers, which is really interesting. And then you think about also where's the mitochondria, where's the energy flows, right? Because you've got sarcoplasmic reticulum, those are ATP-dependent calcium pumps, right, to pump the calcium back in. And then ATP, again, for muscle contraction itself. So pretty neat. So if we look at some of this, and this is all online, it's on the webpage. I put a new song up for you also, if you have to go to the webpage. So it's up there in the webpage, it's a massive file, like 100 megabytes or something. But anyways, we look at the locus and the beetle, comparing the time and relative force. So the locus very fast, the beetle, you know, quite slow, actually, in comparison, right, on isometric twitches. And then if we go through and try to look a little bit more about some of these differences that were in this paper, pretty neat. Think about the cross-sectional area being quite large on the beetle compared to the locus. Also, then we go on down to the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and we think of fast contraction, calcium suck it back in quickly so you can contract again. Some of the differences people looked at. Now, one thing we have to kind of think about also too is the invertebrates, insects, they don't use their circulatory system so much for transporting oxygen and getting rid of CO2. They have a tracheal system with trachea branch, so it's like they're like our lungs branching to all our muscles in our body and having air to exchange right down to the muscle. So these trachea go right down into the muscle and branch out. So that's the gas exchange. So if we have a tracheal system, you know, that can take up space as well, right, in the muscle. So these tracheals right down to the muscle for gas exchange. And that's kind of interesting, too, because some of these trachea actually fill up with fluid, and they can't have a good gas exchange until that muscle contracts, and it kind of pushes the fluid out to the interstitium, if you will, and out to the body. And then those trachea are used for gas exchange. So some really neat aspects people are now modeling and looking at how gas exchange works with muscle contraction. But some neat aspects with this. So if we look at some of these muscles that we were just talking about, and the forces that they were looking at, remember the locus very fast and the beetle slower. So the beetle muscles on average with 32 kilonewtons per meter squared versus 360. So we have quite a bit of stress that this animal can deal with. And some of these others that were reported in synchronous muscles range from up to 400. So where is that with humans about? Is that, I forgot the numbers we were having.
For stress on?
Stress on the
being able. Eccentric contraction.
Yes.
500 newtons square meter. Kilopascals.
That'd be close.
Newtons per square centimeter.
This is meters.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we have to convert it.
Yeah.
See what I think that'd be a great exercise, right, for it to come
So,
we can't do it.
Is the beetle a synchronous muscle and the locus asynchronous? Is that?
The locus is more of a asynchronous.
Okay.
That's right. I think that's right. Yes. Something else.
Right. The muscle is 250 for isometric, 500 for eccentric on average, kilopascal, or pascal is the first one.
An amazing amount. So we can go through some of the stress they actually worked up here on some of these figures. Let's see if I can get to this. And you look at some of the cross sections of these muscles. So A up here is asynchronous. And then the synchronous muscle down here. And we begin to think about, you know, look at the mitochondrial size in here and the muscle size. Quite an amazing difference. And even the banding pattern when people, I mean, cross-sectional pattern, the actin to myosin ratios are a bit different too. And we'll go through a little bit of that. So here's this stress that they were actually measuring in the beetle and the locust. So let's see, the beetle's on the top, locust is here, see if I understand this graph right. So here's during stimulation, right? And then they stretch. And then they measure this, the force of the stress on the muscle. And then they relax it. And they can then do these kind of experiments, I think, that Ken was talking about the other day, right? So pretty neat when they compare these and between the beetle muscle and the locus muscle, you can see when you're stimulating, start to stimulate, the beetle muscle isn't already developing too much stress on that. Whereas if you stimulate here in the locus, you already are developing quite a bit of stress on that muscle. So actually when they separated this out, this little table down here is the stiffness, how stiff when they pull on that muscle, that the beetle was higher than that locus muscle. But then when they start to look at the actives and it's being contracted or stimulated, from what I understand, is that then the locus muscle is actually very stiff compared to the beetle muscle. So I guess in here, this is going to be maybe stiffer after the contraction than it would be for that, because you can get more movement while you're stimulating it in the beetle. Does that make sense? As far as I understand this. So it's kind of neat to think that there's differences in this stiffness of the muscle too. Maybe that has a lot to do with being able to move readily if you're pulling on one and then allowing it to contract in an asynchronous manner. And then as Tim was showing, this figure was in the paper. It was kind of neat. So this was a beetle up here. And what they were looking at is the work that was utilized if you are contracting and relaxing, and this, from what I understand, and this shows that you're actually getting work out of it. But in this system, when you were looking at the locus, it actually had the opposite pattern, so it actually would absorb energy instead of being able to produce energy or produce work. Does that make sense, Tim?
It does. Humans are the one on the right.
Okay.
We lose energy. Okay. But at the top left one, they're actually kind of getting work out of it.
They're getting work out of it, absolutely. Right, so it's kind of neat. And so that was a neat paper that went through all these, kind of pulled different aspects together, I thought, what we covered earlier. And then this guy's really done quite a bit of work, and I'm looking at different muscles and the ability to contract and the time frame in these different muscles. So if we looked at the time required to activate the muscle, and you think about calcium diffusion, you know, what are some of the limitations for this? So he's actually thinking about the sarcoplasmic reticulum with the muscle size, and we can think about time required for calcium diffusion and some of the assumptions that were made about how fast the concentrations of calcium that's inside of the muscle fiber, for example, and then the diffusion coefficient, and then to be able to diffuse, you know, for the myofibril diameter, how fast can calcium get to the troponins, basically? And then to terminate, right, to take that calcium away so the muscle can relax, because you can't be on calcium around all the time. So thinking about how fast the calcium would have to move for those contraction rates. So trying to put numbers to it and thinking about for relaxation, you know, have to move pretty quick to take up that calcium. What's really interesting too, and some of these muscles that they found in invertebrates, and they don't understand it even to this day. You have a muscle, you're stimulating it, you already depolarize it, you know, maybe with an electrode and voltage clamping it, and you can get that contraction, right? But if you hyperpolarize it, it can actually relax faster with hyperpolarization than just turning off the stimulus. So they think that the sarcoplasmic reticulum can actually detect the voltage change, and that there might be differences on the voltage change of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. If you hyperpolarize the cell somehow, it can actually relax faster. So there's one article I was reading actually said that they didn't, they haven't seen, or I don't know if people have actually tried it throughout mammalian species or even amphibian species with hyperpolarizing membrane and looking at relaxation rates in different mammals and in amphibians. So it's kind of interesting, and I just kind of Googled last night to look up some more aspects, and I haven't seen that being addressed, actually. So maybe there's something unique that we found in the invertebrates with hyperpolarizing muscles and actually showing contraction rates, or relaxation rates, to actually be enhanced. And they think it has something to do with the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So that's kind of neat, you know, something really odd that we don't think about often. And then if we think about these cross-sections of the muscle, different types of muscle, and if you look at, like we said, the sarcoplasmic reticulum, just to think about what it would be like with the tubules, basically, and the size of these mitochondria packing in that muscle, and how wide do you want the contractile element? If it's too big, then you can't get the calcium in there, and you can't get it out fast enough, right? Or the ATP to actually move into these regions. So the limitations of what people are trying to work on. And there's some nice papers about looking at invertebrates in different environmental temperatures, because diffusion rates would be slower, right? And so in warmer temperatures, you could actually have a larger contractile unit inside the muscle compared to cold water animals that will be harder for calcium to move in and out the contractile element. So people are trying to compare different species in their environment. And so that's kind of neat. And then you think about some of these species actually move from cold to warm and warm to cold environments. And, you know, now they have some other challenges with them. And then we can look at some of these. This muscle was really quite neat, this cross-section that Katie did. And that nice arrangement with the sarcoplasmic reticulum and the mitochondria space throughout. Just kind of cool to see these different muscle arrangements. So we think about that contractile element in there. And easily access to calcium and calcium taken back up with the ATP as well. I find it amazing that you could look at the nerve terminal on these kind of muscles, and the nerve is so small. The nerve terminal is about the size of the mitochondria in the muscle. But the nerve has mitochondria too, right? So what makes mitochondria so large in skeletal muscle, but so small in a nerve terminal? So the mitochondria and the nerve terminal are a fragment of the size of these things. So how does mitochondria, you know, change the size? Supposedly it all came from one source, right? In us. But it's the same thing in us too. Our mitochondria and our nerve terminals at our neuromuscular junction are very small compared to the mitochondria in our muscle. Isn't that weird? And it all came from who? Your dad or your mom? Mom, right? Mitochondrial DNA, right? So it's kind of interesting it all came from the same source. Okay, so if we start to look at some of the comparisons that people have made, looking at different species, they were actually looking at the percent of sarcoplasmic reticulum compared to the twitch duration, and so they plotted it for different species. What was that? The sonic muscle of a lobster. So the sarcoplasmic reticulum being so large, yeah, but the twitch duration actually can be quite long, I mean quite short. So having the sarcoplasmic reticulum dump calcium out and take it back up really fast, right? So imagine the relationship. Let's see which one's the short sarcoplasmic reticulum. The leg muscles of this. I think it's a little parasite. So that's kind of neat. No, it says a leg. I don't know what that really is. Actually,
so we look at these different kind of muscles arrangements, like Tim was mentioning the other day, pinnate arrangements. That's common, actually, in many of the arthropods. Because of why, it's the way the structures of the apodine comes in, and you can easily have this arrangement coming off in this fashion. But you see a variety of different ways. So this is common in the crustacean limbs, for example, insect limbs as well. But a lot of variety out there,
which makes it interesting if one wanted to get into comparative structure-function relationships. We look at cross-sections among different animals. This is kind of neat, too.
So here we have mollusk, octopus, some really neat ones. What was this other one over here? That was really odd. That was a chiaoderm, you know, and then you think about the arrangements of some of these muscles. There was a paper about the, what do you call those animals with all the little spines again? It's an echinoderm. you know, in the ocean. So neat that they were looking at the muscles at the base of each one of those little spines and then how it can move those spines all over different directions. And pretty neat to think about all those muscles that were allowing that those little spines to move around. But the pattern that they make. And many of these patterns of the muscles, like in the insects and crustaceans, you can actually see the attachment points on the cuticle because when it's soft, it makes that kind of pull on it. Actually, that pretty structure that you see in the back of a crab, for example, the little shape on the back, that's actually where the heart attaches because the heart's contracting the whole time and even pulling on that soft cuticle and hold, and it leaves a nice demarcation where the attachment points are for the heart of a crustacean. So kind of neat. If we look at some of these differences here too, so I'm just kind of go through a few of these main points to take home. Think of the differences which they call phasic and tonic, you know, fast and slow in general terms, right? And just like what we're already used to, it depends on that animal. So when they look at a fast muscle in one animal, that actually might be more of a slow type than another. So within that animal, when they look at fast and slow, so this is where it gets a little confusing sometimes, because that might be a bit different species. But generally, the sarcomere length and the basic muscles are really short. And in the tonic muscles, the sarcomeres are quite long. And then we think about the sarcoplasmic cingulum along with it. And then the T-tubule system. But in some papers, they don't just call it a T-tubule system, they actually call it a Z-tube. Because it, right at the Z-disc, they see this invagination in the tube. And then other places where the plasma membrane kind of comes in, they call that more of a T-tubule. Sometimes it follows the Z, so they call it Z-tubule. It might be a little bit confusing sometimes looking at it. But look at the actin-myosin ratio, too, which varies among these tonic and phasic type of muscles. And then we see in the cockroach, phasic and tonic again, the tonic being much longer than the phasic, right? And then we look at regular on the A-band, but at the Z in the A-band, and again, the ratio kind of fits with the same as in the lobster. Dragonfly, dorsal ventral muscles for, this is a respiratory more of a muscle, this isn't, but again, the tonic muscle is a little bit longer, and then we think about sarcoplasmic not so well developed, but look at the ratio of the actin to the myosin, quite different again.
Let me make sure. Okay, so.
And then we think of something else that we haven't really talked about much about these muscles. If you're going to depolarize the sarcoplasmic cingulum to get calcium out, you have to then have what? You know, electrical conduction, right? So you think about the biophysical properties of the muscle itself. Think about how the speed of contraction or the speed of electrical signals can travel on that membrane. And if you have a membrane that's leaky, right, what's going to happen to your electrical signal as you go along that membrane? If it's relatively a leaky membrane with a low resistance, means a lot of leak channels, if you depolarize here and you go to the other end of that muscle, you're going to have a smaller electrical potential, which means it might not open the dihydropyridine receptors, right, or at least cause a conformational change, but then you can pull out the pyrimidine receptor. So those properties are important for even the electrical signals that then travel down and initiate the muscle contraction. So not to try to memorize any numbers here, but the general idea is that we have to think about resistance or membrane resistance, because if you have a leaky cell, so low resistance versus high resistance, if you have a leaky cell, that electrical signal will attenuate much quicker than if you had a high resistance membrane. So high resistance membrane, you're going to maintain that electrical signal a lot better. Then you think about, well, would that relate to the amount of innervation on that muscle? If you have a muscle that's high in resistance, you're going to be able to maintain that electrical signal. But if it's really low in resistance, maybe that signal will dampen too quickly, so maybe you want the nerve to make multiple contacts on that muscle, that same nerve that makes multiple contacts, so you can depolarize all over the muscle. So that kind of changes the properties then of being locally contracted versus contract that whole muscle together, right? Unlike us, mammals, action potential in the middle of your muscle fibers spreads very quickly to the relatively short muscle fibers. So it's just something to think about, and the idea of length constant is how fast that electrical signal will decay. It's basically 63%. quite a long ways before it decays. Remember, beautiful decay is relatively quick, let's print. And that all fits together a lot with the membrane resistance
and signals. Time constant is important too. That's
related to the capacity plus the capacitance of the muscle plus the resistance of the muscle. So if you have a signal that goes up quick and comes down slowly versus goes up quick and comes down fast, the fast one's a short time constant. The one that goes up and comes down slowly, that would be a long time constant. So that matters if you have depolarization, right? Because if you go up and you depolarize again, you can build a higher signal, right?
Is that too crazy? Just something to think about. If you had another depolarization here, if you had a short time constant, let's say it decays, that's tau, you know, short, versus a long one, and you gave these two signals, well, that doesn't work. That's
purple. Purple.
Well, whatever it is.
Thank you. Make sure to get that back to you. All right. So here we go. And if that had a long time constant, and then you gave that second pulse, you could see that you're building up on top of that one. So you end up with a higher depolarization, and then you have a greater chance to get more calcium to be released from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Right? So it makes a difference for muscle contraction, the amount of muscle contraction as well that you might get out of that. And looking at the different animals and some of them, you know, being able to really compact that muscle down, what's interesting is this paper is a bit different. They were going back and actually looking back at the Huxley model, seeing that the way these muscles can, the contractile part of the muscle can actually compress down or maybe expand out the way the muscle moves, but that meant that way back when, Huxley was even thinking about this idea of the being flexible for the hinge, because that would then allow this to still be able to rotate well and have good force with the muscle changing its width between the actin and the myosin.
It's kind of interesting. And a lot of the invertebrates people tried to measure these differences under contraction and relaxation, but kind of hard, I guess, to do some of those experiments. So if we look at some of these tables, again, kind of neat, not to memorize things, but just to see that people are actually doing a lot of comparative aspects. So up here is more of, I think these are more of vertebrate skeletal muscles up here, you know, like frog, rat, human, and then looking at the sarcomere length. Pretty similar, right? Now we start looking at sarcomere length in a lot of the invertebrates. And these things really vary quite a bit. You know, 8 up here, and I think there's one that goes all the way to 20 sarcomere length, which is quite amazing. So again, if you start to look at these differences, phasic and tonic type of muscles, this is how they classify these differences pretty much too, is that the tonic muscles have much longer sarcomeres than the phasic muscles, which have shorter sarcomeres, but that variation is quite substantial. Even the myosin length, you can see then what's varying, right? Myosin lengths, right? So more heads that combine to it on a longer length. And then, again, dimensions of how big those muscle fibers are. So kind of neat to think about. And if we look at, did I miss one? No. If we look at what people were really quite interested in is some of these super contracting muscles. So normally, the vertebrate skeletal muscle, insect-like muscle, contract pretty much, but you know, you see 100% length, 98% rest length, you know, slight change, but you get the force out of that. Whereas you look at these super contracting muscles, the Z discs are spaced apart, and you can actually have these muscles where they go past the Z disc and can super contract. And so this is really quite unusual. So this really got people going about some of the models that were put forth before about if you had these super contracting muscles, how could they do that and actually pass the Z line? Right. So kind of neat to think about these super contracting muscles. And I had something here about this. Here it is. while the supercontracting muscle down to about 16% of the resting length compared to the conditions in normal vertebrate muscle, where approximately 60% of the resting length can be seen. So neat that it could actually get that much smaller compared to the vertebrate muscle. So neat, when you start to think about these banding patterns that people were describing a long time ago, and then you see this change, this kind of opened up. Maybe these ideas are a little bit different about how the muscle's contracting. And even back, quite a while back, people were trying to understand some of these. And if we get to that, we'll look at some of those older papers. But this was quite neat, looking at the different genes and proteins. And so people compare, and this one was mostly... this guy, Scott Hopper, has been working in this area for a good while. He's just, I think he's still up in Ohio. But you look at the different colors here, the black, the green, the red. And the red is asynchronous muscles. And let's see, insects in green. What do we have here? Insects in red, sorry, asynchronous muscles. Insects in green do not. And insects in blank haven't even in black haven't even been looked at yet. So quite a difference is in the insect world, even within, you know, groups, but there's still a lot to be looked at, it looks like. And that paper wasn't too old. So I think there's still a lot to be out there to be discovered and interesting. And if we start to think about these insect muscles and the way people were actually looking at it, and trying to understand more about the contractile element, kind of neat. We talked about it in the midterm exam, and what was the fellow that just defended again? Physiology? Shavar, right? He was actually talking about these muscle proteins, C, myosin proteins, which are accessory type proteins that can be phosphorylated and change properties as well. And so people are looking at those also in inverted preparations, these accessory type of proteins that might change properties. So there's our general structure, right? And then what people were looking at was kind of interesting because they were looking at that structure and looking at the different types of proteins that they could find. And so in C. elegans, little worm, finding different, and here's chitin. And we see some other ones, insect projectin, asynchronous muscles. This protein is expressed here, but not in the other spots on the sarcomere. So we just see different, the point here is just different proteins expressed in different regions that people can look at, and it's not always the same that we might think in different animals. And so Drosophila, both chitin and connectin, it's a different type of the isoform of chitin, but it only is expressed in certain aspects, like where the Z-discs are, so maybe it's more of an anchoring protein there. And more to be discovered, I think. So when we think about, you know, the ultimate way to classify muscle may be seeing for particular proteins like myosin or something, you're going to have to probably look think about getting species-specific antibodies that you can then work with, right? Because it might not hold. So if we look at some of these myosin filaments, quite neat. This paper was looking at this parasite and comparing some of the differences, and it opened up some questions because it contracts well. It looks like a smooth muscle because it doesn't have that striations, but it still uses myosin acting, right? We haven't really talked about smooth muscle. It's a whole weird beast on its own, right? Smooth muscle, how it works. But myosin acting, myosin head binding. But when they take cross sections through there, they see this kind of arrangement, right, of the units like myosin acting around it and some dense bodies in there again. Some like T-tubule system, mitochondria. But when they started to look at it a little bit more, it's quite interesting on looking at the different types of myosin. We talked about that a little bit earlier. This one seems to be in kind of its own group completely. And then where they can actually look at the different myosins that are closely related in sequence compared to other animals. And you see like the squid and the fruit fly relatively close here. Closer than, say, the other species that are up there, invertebrates. So just to kind of get an idea that people looking at species differences for evolutionary purposes and seeing that some are closely related and others aren't. But you think about here's a fruit fly striated, and then here's a fruit fly non-muscle but other types of myosin, like myosin 2 versus, you know, cardiac skeletal muscle versus smooth muscle. but so these myosins being grouped in, but that these that in animal that we were just talking about fits with this myosin too up here in this skeletal muscle type of myosins. So basically, something just to, there was something in this conclusion that I found was interesting, and let me see what it was again. That was really neat. Oh yeah, that this myosin seemed to be a hybrid between the regular type of striated muscle and smooth muscle, so a little bit different. And it kind of challenged some of these ideas that smooth and striated muscle always so different in their components, but that it's, you know, has the same kind of contractile components with myosin and actin working together. But a lot of differences in the smooth muscle. A lot of work done in the crab system because of the size of these muscles and the ease of keeping them alive at room temperature. So just minimal saline, put in a dish, stays alive. You don't have to worry about all the temperature and pH so much that they can handle the temperature changes without dying. And so a lot of work has been done on crab muscles for this purpose. There's some differences in these different types that people have classified these muscles. Basically, here they're calling them just generally like an A type and B type. So let's go through some of these A types and B types. It's kind of neat. The A type muscle fibers, like this invertebrate fast acting muscle, you know, Z lines, M lines, they have the hollow tube of the thick filament. So if they do the cross section of the tubes of the myosin, actually it's hollow. So that's kind of neat to think about. And again, that kind of arrangement of the actin myosin. Arrangement in a 3-1. And then we get down to the V-type. These are in the antennae and abductor claw muscles, more of the slow type. They lack the M-lines. And again, these junctions of the A-band, I-band, thick and filaments don't have that hexagonal arrangement. And then we have like a 6-7-1 ratio. So some differences that are going on there. And the net plasma membrane invagination with the Z lines. So it's kind of neat. Like start off in particular. So to kind of compare these muscle types, people were looking at this in the crab, and you can see these are quite interesting. And here is, let's see if this showed up here. Here is just what some people were classifying it as an N band. I think this is showing better. Anyways, it's in this figure here. Not the M band, but an N band. N is a Nancy. An N band that it appeared, and people started to classify this band, but they could see sometimes in contracting muscle, but they wouldn't see it in the relaxed muscle. And some papers actually had mentioned that they think it was something extruded from the A band that made the N band. And now that we think about it, it's probably something to do with Titan. And maybe the proteins, maybe even a coil or something. I don't know exactly where it goes from there, you know, following the history. But it's kind of interesting to think about that band could disappear in different states as well, and probably having to do with the way the muscle contracts, maybe with the type of proteins associated with it. But the points to think about too here is that you can see this nice little wiggy zetus there versus some of the others that are actually very straight. And let's see, there's something else here I want to talk about. Oh, that, you know, the sarcomere lengths in figure 3, that's this one right here. Look how long they are compared to the sarcomeres here. Quite different. And the dyads, again, like the sarcoplasmic reticulum we've already talked about. All right, and if they do these cross sections, they see differences in the myosin structure in there being like tubes versus more solid, so that there can be more of a tube-like structure in that myosin when they do the cross-section staining with electron microscopy, so that's kind of cool too. And let's see, there was something here about this. Let's see what the particular, I copied this for some reason. Oh, the A muscles, more like the fast contracting invertebrate muscle, and the B type is more like the slow acting invertebrate muscle. And so that was kind of neat that these characterizations were in the animal, that they could compare again. And these a little bit different on the insect flight muscle and with the vertebrate comparing. So this was interesting. This paper, let's see if I had a reference for this paper, a date. Yeah, 1956, here it is. And so some of these people that you hear about, like Graham Hoyle and Hodge, these people were really comparative biologists and did a lot of the work back in these days. But this is interesting. In the main current controversy, so there must have been a lot of controversy at the time, in relation to muscle structure centers around two models. One, what might be termed the classical model, in which the continuous skeletal framework of myofilaments transverses all bands of the sarcomere, and the band pattern erasing from interstitial materials, kind of like that end disc that we were just talking about, that end band. And then the other type, the Huxley type, which he guess didn't really favor, an interdigitating model advocated by Huxley and Hansen in the various forms. The later model, primarily array of filaments in the A band of vertebrate muscle, is identified as myosin and the secondary as actin. The bulk of the evidence appears to favor the classical model, so not the, you know, the Huxley model. So kind of interesting when they're looking at, dependent on which species they're looking at in the muscles. So think of Huxley maybe started with invertebrates more than the vertebrate. You know, what would his model be the same way, or would it be an advanced muscle a lot differently if he had compared a lot of different animals? And this is the same problem you see over and over again in biology or physiology. Remember Harvey with the circulatory system, right? He was a comparative person, but he was actually working for the king at this time, you know, in England, and he held off publishing his work for 10 years because he was too afraid to go against the tradition of the anatomist and the cardiovascular people that were in Italy at the time. They thought he would be boohooed, you know, and his credit would be discredited. So he held off on his comparative analysis of how blood flew through the body, and actually with that veins had little valves, and that the heart worked in a way, and it's like a closed system. And so he knew all this, and then finally, he just had enough, I guess, and he published his book, and people were like horrified. But then when people started to back it up and do their own studies, they realized everything he said was true. And then the Italian anatomists were kind of like boo-hoo. But he was so scared about publishing his work, kind of like, you know, Charles Darwin too. But then, you know, time holds, and the aspect of science is that you can reproduce and redo those experiments over and over again. So this was kind of interesting that there was this controversy back in the 50s, mostly probably a lot to do with the comparative people that were looking at invertebrate muscles compared to vertebrate muscles. So what's kind of neat is that a lot of this came about because of the staining that they were doing and seeing these bands go all the way through. And I know this is too much text, but the idea is these figures will come up on the next part. That they were seeing these muscles, the banding pattern, and these proteins that were going all the way through the whole from Z-disc to Z-disc. And it kind of made them think about a lot of the anatomy that was being proposed. So they looked at these different structures and could see these kind of filaments that were going all the way from Z disc to Z disc. And here's this end band again in the muscle. They thought it came out of maybe some matter that was in the A band that they couldn't identify. But when they changed contraction rates, they could actually start to see this banding pattern that would show up. Maybe it had something to do with the tightening of the proteins around it. I'm not sure, but it's kind of neat to think about. And then they would look at these differences in the myosin too. You could see that some of the myosins were actually hollow in these sections versus if it was, you know, a solid myosin in the section as well. So different ideas about how the myosin might have come together too, instead of just being a solid base. So Graham Hoyle is one of the, like a god in comparative muscle work. And he worked for many years at Oregon, and he did a lot of comparative work, and he's written some books on this too. This goes way back to 1967, so you can imagine, quite old work, but his work pretty much stood the stand of time, and he worked on so many different species of animals and really came up some neat overviews. But generally, what we've been talking about, you know, has held up over the time when they've done these comparative studies. But he just noted some really odd muscles, and that, you know, didn't really fit the way that we think about muscle banding pattern. And look at this. This Z disc kind of moves around. Again, you know, not too structured in here, but you'd see these dense bodies throughout mitochondria. So it kind of opened up different ideas about how the muscle might be contracting. You can see here between these two muscles, look at the differences here, all this sarcoplasmic reticulum, and then the packing differences of these muscles right next to each other, quite different as well. And then people beginning to try to address what's going on with the myosins and having that hollow center versus the solid center. So people came up with different models and different ideas that they had at the time. So you see some of these proteins from zetas go all the way to the other zetas. So they were proposing these proteins that went all the way from zetas to zetas. And you think about, you know, Titan today and the way that they could, you know, maybe think about it but didn't have the ability to identify these different proteins. But what's really interesting is some of these differences that they came about, seeing that these proteins went all the way across. So some of these, look at this last statement here. Likewise, the notion of active state development by the A.V. Hill School may be seriously questioned. I mean, you know, so they were really driving the point home that some of these models didn't hold. So these people really had to, you know, back up with what they were saying. And so people were on quite a bit. So we just talked about Scott Fedler. He was at Colorado State working with Don Michaels. He's at another university now, and he's actually teaching a muscle course as well. But he did this really nice study. I wish we could get him to Skype in or something. But let me just go through these tables. I don't want to give you a heart attack that you have to memorize all these, but just look at the work that he did in comparing different animals and looking at the muscle, the mass, the Vmax, the power output, and the different temperatures. They put together a wonderful review article that people could, you know, go through. And if you look at some of these numbers, this power, you know, the variation up here, 2,200, which one's that? This is a crab, Carcinus manus. This is a little green crab. So amazing power out of that one. Some of these, you know, quite variable. There's only 252, that's a tree frog. You know, so he's comparing a lot of different animals, trying to get some generalities that he can come up with. And he's gone through birds and mammals and, you know, everything that he can imagine. Everything that he can find in the literature, pretty much, he started to go through and pull it all together. So pretty neat. And when he comes down to it, then he started making all these graphs, the Vmax and the mass, and he came up with a few conclusions by looking at the correlations here. And so it's kind of neat. And we come down to this wonderful graph, which I really love, the first ones here, crustaceans, power, right? You look at that crustacean muscle, what's this, 550 or so about? Kilonewtons per meter squared, and we look at pathetic mammals down here, you know, buried reptiles, fish, and birds, and so it's kind of interesting, but there's, you know, a lot of variation in these invertebrates as well.
What is which muscle you took the fibers from?
Oh, all different muscles.
Oh.
Oh, yeah, so it's
so
on.
In human, you can only have the common sex.
Let's see what he did in the human. I guess he's looking at a 2A type here, a 2B type here.
Yeah, but even like if properties is 2A muscles in our vastus, they would be different than properties of 2A and different muscles.
Different animals.
And so, like, in the crustacean, you use their claw, I think. So it's like you've selected a muscle where you'd expect this really dramatic.
A large difference. And so I think that's the part that he mentioned here, is that he actually has a couple crustaceans muscles out of, say, one animal, like this American lobster.
And oh, he does. He has some of the animals.
So he's looking at a couple different muscles.
And then how did it slow back up to the claw?
Right. Where's the claw? Oh, here? Yeah, claw closer. These two different closures, this is the cancer mat,
and that hour is like 2,000.
Uh-huh. And this other one is only 8. Oh no, that's the gel at fall. So let's look at these two. So here's 829 and 2,200. So both of these are pretty strong in that particular.
But one, is that say one's an abdominal extensor?
Uh-huh.
For cancer, is there a power up
there? He didn't have the data for that, so it's just not there.
Going to slow abdominal down in the lobster.
Where does it get that one? Lobster, fast abdominal. But which abdominal muscle? There's a number of muscles in there. So he just has these as kind of maybe. probably calculated in the primary paper, right? Maybe there's some wiggle room in there, so we may have to look at these references to really figure it all out and probably dive into it. But yeah, it's probably, there's a lot of gray areas about little subtleties about exactly how they measured and did things. And then you worry about temperature too, right? As we were talking about, different temperatures and how they controlled, were they all done at the same temperature for equal comparisons? Calcium bath, everything that makes a difference. Seawater animals, freshwater invertebrates, you've got a crayfish, freshwater, seawater, lobsters, calcium concentrations completely different on the outside as well as inside the cells compared to a freshwater crustacean. So we didn't really get into the differences in the ionic balances, but there's a lot of differences in ionic balances as well. Some of the, and it wasn't discovered until kind of later, that actually many of the crustacean species, if you vary the chloride concentration on the outside, it will actually vary the chloride concentration on the inside. So some of them can actually be leaky to chloride, where other, like mammalian mussels, aren't so leaky to chloride. So what's the deal there? I mean, why is it so leaky to chloride? And that can change the resting membrane potential, and then that can change the driving gradient for calcium as well. So lots of questions still to be answered, but the more they investigate, the more, you know, questions that come about, right? So that was kind of neat. Just to pull it together, you know, kind of that there's a big variation there, and he's aware of that, so it's kind of cool. So let's see what his kind of summary statements were here. And he's open about some of this. I think there was something really neat here. The Vmax should decrease as the animal increases in size. That was some of the aspects that came out. With a detailed protein analysis, the shift in troponin I isoforms in the larger animals, with no detectable changes in the myosin heavy chain isoforms, really. Myofibril ATPase activity in some of the fish, slow as the fish increases in size, so the ATPase activity changing with the development of the animal. So depending on what stage you might look at that particular fish, you know, if it's young versus old, you might get a different type of isoform in the myosin. So that's kind of neat, too. You know, larger lizards possess more slower muscles compared to some of the smaller ones. So some neat differences. I think there was one other difference here. This the dragonfly muscles, this was an excellent example of a type of study that might be applied to the questions that they have here because they see some of the differences in these animals. The flight muscles have alternative splicing of the troponin Ts and have completely differences in the way that the wing beat frequency and the power output might be present along with calcium sensitivity. So when you're looking at these species, maybe, like you said, depending on that muscle that you're really looking at, but also the developmental stage of that animal, and you might get complete differences as well. So when all those studies were done, at what stage animal, all that could make a difference as well.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I think some of it is that, like Tim was mentioning before, I think the muscle gets thicker too, right? Doesn't Vmax go slower? But no, Vmax, no, muscle would be longer.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. Longer muscles. See, just longer. So series element versus parallel element. Some of this higher force production in some crustacean muscles arise because of their long sarcomeres, right? Just as we talked about in series, right? So they have these really long sarcomeres. And some of the barnacles, I think they've got them up to 20 microns in some barnacle muscles. So that's really amazing. And then the general idea that we've kind of covered over and over again, and the vast being with more sarcoplasmic reticulum.
So anyways, just to kind of pull together all that literature was an amazing feat, I think, that he tried to do. And again, just to kind of think about
the differences in the ratios of the thick to thin filaments, we see pretty much consistent in the vertebrate systems, right? But quite a bit of variation in the invertebrates. So you think about how many actin around the myosin, then you have to think about those myosin heads.
So that's my alarm that somebody's going to be knocking at the door here soon. Okay, so let me just... So this is what we've already talked about, endoplasmic reticulum, some differences. But I just want to go through this picture really quick. This picture was actually taken from tarantula muscle. And they found out that the tarantula muscle, stealth muscle,
really preserves well. They can isolate it, and they can keep the structure really nice, so they can actually do electron microscopy. So a lot of understanding more about some of the details came from tarantula muscle, and that's what people are working with now, and they can actually get really good imaging on the myosin heads and looking at the arm and looking at the flexibility of the arm in tarantula muscle. So they're doing more and more on tarantula muscle under different states and trying to understand how that whole myosin head moves. So some pretty cool stuff. Whereas the vertebrate muscle was falling apart a lot, and they couldn't get it as well as this tarantula muscle. So later, maybe we can spill a little bit of time, sometime later down the course, maybe something about it, talking a little bit about some of the differences in other animals. But Kenaeton, we talked about, is this maybe an isoform of kind of the Titan in different groups. We didn't get a chance to talk about some of these differences in the whole properties of electrophysiology of the animals, but just to kind of think about crustacean muscles in general, the long ones, they would actually produce graded responses, and they're even from their electrical signals, where these short ones are more of a phasic type, they will actually make very large EPSPs, excitatory postsynaptic potentials, whereas the slower muscles generally are graded and they don't spike. So think about it. This is interesting. Even a Drosophila larval muscle, you can stimulate the motor nerve, recording the muscle, and you get a graded depolarization. But look at the animal as an adult, you stimulate the nerve, and you get an action potential in the muscle. You know, complete differences in some of the properties. So you think about the channel differences that are in the membranes, too. Many of the invertebrate muscles, crustaceans, and arthropods, calcium comes from the extracellular fluid. They have voltage-gated calcium channels on their plasma membrane. So in some of these animals, it's not so much the calcium in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, it's calcium in the bath around the animal. So you don't have to really you have to think differently maybe on your experiments as well. Some invertebrate muscles, like some of the insects that have very small muscle cells, they don't even have a T-tubule system. They don't need it because it's just a single cell that's bathed around the hemolymph around. So you see quite a bit of differences in these animals as well, and a lot of diversity. So I don't. I guess we won't go into this right now. We'll maybe talk about it some other time. But the whole PowerPoint's up online. You can download it. Some differences that we just talked about, generally about tension development too, right? Long sarcomeres, a lot of isometric tension compared to the short sarcomeres, lower tension. And then membrane resistance, as we talked about, that's actually important too for electrical conduction. Low resistance for the faster muscles, they can actually then have that electrical signal to travel quickly, right, because of low resistance. No, I got that backwards. I was looking at last time. These shorter muscles don't need a high resistance because they have short sarcomeres. And actually, the innervation pattern on these, they have multiple nerve branches all over the muscle fiber, too, so they can depolarize everything pretty quickly. It's not so much just in the belly, and you might get this contraction, but depolarization, since the nerve spreads out over it, can depolarize the whole muscle pretty much. So two-thirds of these muscles of the muscle length, pretty much two-thirds of it is innervated by the nerve. So that's a lot of innervation right on the nerve, on the muscle itself. Okay, so we might as well pause there, and we can answer questions. You can look at the web, download that web thing. But basically, you know, the main points, right? They covered small, large muscles, sarcomere lengths, all that good stuff.
Email Dr. McCarthy and make sure that he's still okay to come out on Monday and Wednesday.
Oh, yeah. Oh, is he good? He didn't respond back yet. Oh, he did?
No, he didn't yet.
Oh, not yet. Okay. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm boycotting this quiz.
I know. I mean, you can't say that.